Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so we will start. We will be finishing up the discussions on Rav Shach today, probably about half hour, and then we'll move into a completely different type of figure with a completely opposite ideology, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. But before we start, just some comments from last time I need to respond to. I mentioned this Tzvi Weinman, the Haredi historian, and one of you asked me what books he wrote. Well, he has his big one is called Mikatovitz Ad Hei Be'er, Chapters in the History of Agudat Yisrael and Haredi Judaism, New Perspectives. It's a very thick book, published in 1995, full of original research from manuscripts and archives about the history of Agudat Yisrael, the Haredim in Israel, a very important. Unfortunately, this book also shows that the famous letters in Rav Kasher's book of Hatzkufa Gdola, in which certain Haredi Gedolim sign a document that speaks of Israel as Atchal Pagul, or the first flowerings of redemption, that's actually, there's some forgery involved there. Who's responsible for it is not clear. He also published this, it's called V'dam Ashatashiv, which is, again is about Haredi Judaism in the land of Israel, pushing his major point, as I mentioned, was that this business of Emetzes Gedolei Torah has always been a fiction, and that either in the early years of the state, the political leaders were making decisions in opposition to what the Gedolim wanted, and in recent days, as we mentioned, it's opposite, in that the Emetzes Gedolei Torah is completely a rubber stamp organization because you have one Gadol, or two Gedolim, who are making the decisions. It's by no means a democracy. Katowice, by the way, is the place where Agudat Yisrael was founded, the first convention in 19, or conference in 1912. A couple other things. I had mentioned last question, sometimes you speak, and only after you say it, you realize that you misspoke, so it's good I can have a chance to correct it. I said that Rav Moshe Feinstein was close to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. That's not exactly a proper statement, because I don't think the Lubavitcher Rebbe was close to anyone. He was a king, and people like that live very lonely lives at the top. However, it's true that Rav Moshe respected the Rebbe very much, and the Rebbe respected Rav Moshe very much. In fact, the Rebbe sent people, I know one in particular, to get smicha from Rav Moshe. There's a famous response of Rav Moshe to the Rebbe explaining why he doesn't wear tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam, and Rav Moshe Feinstein always protected the Rebbe when there were others in the Lithuanian world who wanted to attack him. As I mentioned, and this is an important theme, there were those in the non-Hasidic world who always felt very close to the Rebbe. Since I have some people from Canada, I'll mention Rav Hirschsprung. Rav Hirschsprung was another one, very close to the Rebbe. Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. And then, of course, you had those who thought the Rebbe was terrible and was destroying Judaism. No, the Rav was not close to the Rebbe at all. In fact, the Rav had no real contact with the Rebbe from the time they came to America. At the Rebbe Shiva, the Soloveitchik Shiva, the Rebbe sent the messengers, and the Rav went to one of his from Rangan. But he was not at all close. And if you look in Shaulson's book, Larger Than Life, he has an interview there with Chaim Soloveitchik in which he discusses his father's relationship. However, the Rav always had a great deal of respect for the Rebbe and always thought of the Rebbe as one of the Gedolim, and that the Rav was one of those people. He came from a Chabad background, having grown up in Chaslovich, which was a Chabad town, so he had a lot of respect for him. A couple other things here. Just because we mentioned last class, this problem that I told you I raised with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I asked Rav Aaron Soloveitchik straight out. He considers the Lubavitcher Rebbe one of the great Gedolim. Rav Shach is defaming him. And since Rav Aaron thinks the Lubavitcher Rebbe is great, isn't he obligated to put Rav Shach in Chayram? It was sort of a theoretical question, but I was curious to know how to get out of the explicit Rambam, and not just the Rambam, the Gemara. And his response was that today we don't put people in Chayram. Now, this is interesting because this past week, with all the conversion business, there's been a call from Rav Tzvanya Drori, who is one of the big religious Zionist rabbanim, the Rav of Kiryat Shemona, calling upon the religious Zionist community to put this Rabbi Sherman in Chayram, no less than Chayvim L'Hachrim Dayanim Shadibur Sarab Rav Druckman. We must put in Chayram not just Rav Sherman, but all these Dayanim. Based upon the source, the very source that I spoke to Rav Aaron about, that According to the Rambam, anyone who defames a Torah scholar, as Rav Druckman is, he must be put in chayrim and treated as outside the fold, which means he can't be a valid witness, he can't count him to an aliyah, give him an aliyah, can't, you know, everything. So it's interesting that this is being brought back this very week. And in general, I'll say, I don't know how this is going to end. I mean, the Haredim and the non-Haredim have always had a difficult relationship, but if you read the Israeli papers, you see that something's different now. It's almost like we've crossed a Rubicon. Of course, there have been other times it's felt like we've crossed a Rubicon, but here it seems like there was a statement of 80 leading religious Zionist leaders this week, including Rav Lichtenstein, Rashar Yosef Cohen, and others. It seems that it's getting to the point where the Haredim and the religious Zionists simply cannot live together, and it's hard to know where this is going to end. In fact, Jeffrey Wolf, who's a professor at Bar-Ilan, who I believe is training for Dayanus, has been following this very closely. If you look at his blog, and he pointed out something interesting just today. If you saw the Jerusalem Post article today, they quoted this other rabbi in the Rabbanut. His name was Avraham Dov Levine, who's defending the Dayanim who attacked Rav Druckman. And lo and behold, this Rabbi Levine, in the year 2000, he was head of marriages in Jerusalem. This girl came to him. Her father had been killed in the Yom Kippur War 27 years earlier. The chief rabbinate of the army had declared the mother free to marry, and this Avraham Levine refused to permit her to marry, claiming that this was a faulty court. Now, this is 27 years later, and as Rabbi Wolf writes, anyone who knows anything about halakha knows that one never, in capital, reopens the case of an aguna who was freed by a recognized Beit Din. Certainly not a quarter of a century later. One never creates the circumstance to create mamzerim. Why did he do this? He did this because he is part of what is, to my shame, as a proud Litvak, religious commentators are terming the Litaliban. He cares not for anything but the supererogatory demands of his tiny coterie. Otherwise, how does the charlatan dare to term the military rabbinate Beit Din as not being God-fearing? Was he ever in a tank? Did he ever suffer the heat of battle? Does he know the circumstances of what type of remains one might expect to find in a burning tank? And then he goes on to talk about how Rav Avad Yosef freed 1,000 agunot, etc. So the inclusion of Rabbi Levine in this story indicates that conversion is but the tip of the iceberg. The cabal is out to totally destroy the non-Haredi rabbinate and does not care how many lives it destroys in the process. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of what's out there. If you read the Hebrew press this week, the things that are being said about the Haredi Dayanim and about Rav Yashiv and his followers, Rav Yashiv is usually not referred to by name, but the Lithuanian Torah world that doesn't care about converts, it doesn't care about the community, there's just comments and language, and you just heard a sense of it in Rabbi Wolf's comments there, that to call a Bastin a charlatan. We've never heard comments like this before, and it's hard to know where this is going to end. And I'll just finally, with this, conclude again with what Rav Avad Yosef said about this, because Rav Amar, who takes all of his cues from Rav Avad Yosef, they're now mechutanim. Rav Amar's child is married to Rav Avad Yosef's granddaughter, or grandson, I forget which one. He said that this Dayan has no authority, and Rav Druckman's conversions all stand. And Rav Avad Yosef writes, if it is known, if it's known that from the beginning that people are converting are frauds, they don't really want to be Jewish, it's not a real conversion. However, Rav Avadya says, if at the time of conversion we did not know that they really weren't serious, even though at the end it turns out that they weren't serious, but at the time of the conversion, we did not know that. Dinam ki Yisrael mumar shachalti shachatu Yisrael, who they have the halacha of a sinning Jew, and this is exactly Moshe Feinstein's position, because otherwise, you can always revisit conversions. 5 years later, you could see that someone wasn't observing halacha, you could say they didn't have it in a proper intention. And that's Rav Avadya's position, that you can never revisit a conversion carried out by a real Beis Din unless it's known at the time. With certainty, like Rav Unterman said, that if they're living in a non-religious, they're living with a non-religious person, a non-religious kibbutz, etc., etc. In any event, we'll see how this develops, because I read today that the Jerusalem marriage registers are refusing to register these converts as Jewish, even though Rav Amar is ordering them to. So we shall see. This quote from Avadia, email me, I'll send you it. It's I just closed the book, so I can't find it. It's from it's in his Yabi Omer. Just a few questions. The Rav went to pay a shiva call in the 60s. Okay, interesting. Okay, let us move on now. Let's finish up with Rav Shach. Just a few more things. I don't want to go through all about his family because we've done that in the last two classes. Let me just tell you, this son who I've been mentioning, his name is Rav Ephraim Shach. He came to the United States, and I believe it was in the 60s. He went to Yeshiva University. He was in Bern Arava Graduate School. He then taught, if I'm not mistaken, he taught at Flatbush for a while. And he was a typical Mizrahi person. I described the grandchildren, one of whom was not religious, and that shows the complications of Rav Shach's life. In terms of his ideology, as I mentioned, we actually have an entire book about his ideology called Ish Hashkafa. Now, when it says Hashkafa here, it doesn't just mean Hashkafa as an outlook. Hashkafa is the term that's for the Lithuanian Das Torah. They call it Hashkafa. In fact, the opponents, the Hasidim, refer to the people in Bnei Brak as Hashkafistin, that they're led by Hashkafa. I would say that, and Rav Shach would agree, that he was not an innovator whatsoever. He saw himself, and I believe this is correct, as simply following the path of the Chazon Ish and the Stipler. And for the most part, I think this is correct. This is an ideology. This is an extremist Lithuanian ideology. This is not the ideology identified with people like Rav Yechezkel Sarner, Rav Zalman Meltzer, the Jerusalem Haredim. It's really an ideology identified more with Bnei Brak, although the Brisker Rav was in Jerusalem, and he certainly was extreme by our standards. It's an ideology that's strongly anti-Zionist. And when I say anti-Zionist, I don't mean Satmar anti-Zionist. They're not opposed to settlement in the land. They're not opposed to the creation of a Jewish state. But it has to be religious. They're very opposed, however, to secular Zionism and any form of religious Zionism, because what does religious Zionism mean? Religious Zionism means cooperation with secular Zionism. It means creation of an ideology of nationalism. And as we saw in our lectures on the Chazon Ish, that's shotness. You can't mix nationalism, which isn't a Jewish idea, with Torah. Rav Shach's form of Haredism does include strong support, indeed even an obligation for involvement in politics, in the elections. And I think here he does depart from the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish never came out publicly in support of any political party, and as far as I know, never even came out in support of voting in Knesset elections, although he might have. I've never seen it. In fact, I'm sure he didn't, because there's a great debate today whether he did, and if he ever came out, it would be a public thing. What he did do, and there's no contradiction, people would come to him, ask him questions, and he would tell them who he thinks they should vote for. And you have other people saying that he told them not to vote. We know that the Chazon Ish would say different things to different people, depending on what he thought they, where they stood in these areas. But he never identified with a political party. Rav Shach, however, has always been identified with the obligation to vote with a political party. He had to combat extremists on his right, those who argued that it's blasphemy to have anything to do with the state. In addition, the Brisker Rav was more anti-Zionist than the Chazon Ish. But Rav Shach, was, in his opposition to these extremists on the right, gave the following analogy. A woman is walking down the street with a basket of apples. Someone bumps into her, and all the apples go flying, and people start grabbing the apples, you know, to steal them. The woman starts crying, complaining, everyone's stealing my apples. Rav Shach said, that's what the Neturei Karta, the Eda Haredi types do, and the analogy is to the state. We are the women holding the box of apples. The apples have gone everywhere. We can either sit here and cry, and at the end not have any apples, or we can do what the woman should do, try to pick up as many apples as you can, at least try to salvage what you can. And Rav Shach said that by being in the Knesset, we can at least salvage something for yeshiva, something for Torah, and by sitting and just crying how terrible it is that, you know, there's non-religious Jews here trying to pass all these laws, we end up a lot worse. And in truth, in Poland, which is an anti-Semitic country with an anti-Semitic government, Jews were always in the parliament. In fact, Rav Itcher Meir Levin, who was Agudas Yisrael's first deputy, first member of the Knesset, he signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. He was served in the first Israeli government. He gave this analogy. He said, I served with anti-Semites in the Polish parliament. He was a member of that parliament. He goes, for Jewish interests, certainly I can serve in the Israeli parliament for Jewish interests. But as I said, in terms of Hashkafa, there really isn't that much original in Rav Shach, although it was under his reign, if I could use that term, that the Haredi concept of Das Torah achieved its greatest popularity never seen before, and really its stridency, and therefore it's no accident that it's during those years, in the 80s and 90s, that the first scholarly studies of Das Torah appear. One other interesting point which I want to mention, we touched on it last time, let me just develop it a little further, because, again, it's very significant. It shows Rav Shach is not afraid to speak his mind and say what he wants to say, what he thinks is the proper message, even if other people don't want to hear it. And that is his opposition, as I mentioned last class, to Kiruv. Now, everyone knows that today Kiruv has become very big in the Haredi world. And it began, we must be historically accurate, it began with Lubavitch, but now it's very big in the Haredi world. And we've spoken about this in the past. But Kiruv only gets going in the 1980s, Haredi Kiruv. Before then, the Haredim had no interest in Kiruv, and that's why Shlomo Carlbach had to leave Lakewood, because he wanted to do Kiruv, and Rav Aaron said, we don't go out. That's what the Chabad people do. We stay in and learn Torah. Now, of course, as we all know, there are Haredi kolels all over the country, and a prime focus of these Haredi kolels is Kiruv. You even have Haredi spokesmen talking about how Kiruv is vital in today's day and age, and I think their last, one of the Dafyomi conventions or something, they spoke about how essential Kiruv is. Now, one Rosh Kollel, the Rosh Kollel in Boston, acknowledged to me in conversation many years ago that all this learning with lay people, all this Kiruv, really is taking away from the purpose of the Kollel. That's not the purpose of a Kollel. But he said that we won't be able to get any community support unless we do that. But I think this is probably an unusual view, although this is his view. I think if you ask most Rosh Kollel, they will tell you that this outreach is an essential element today. And they will point out that the great Torah scholars in the Haredi world have decided that in today's day and age, Kiruv has to be an essential element in the Haredi worldview. In fact, I think that many of the Kiruv professionals, they call them Kiruv professionals, are precisely the type that have no interest in sitting in Kollel for years. And by going out and doing Kiruv, it's not like they're going out and getting a regular job. They can still remain an important force in the Haredi world. They still have status, and yet they're working for a living. In a way, they wouldn't have had if they had a regular job, and they could see their job as holy work. If you're in the Haredi world and you go out to get a job, you no longer have status in the Haredi world. Only Klei Kodesh have status. And yet it's hard because people need to make a living. So here, if you're working in Kiruv, this is what I think is driving a lot of this. First of all, you can work for a living, and some of them can do quite well if they have rich backers. And you can still regard your work, you can regard your work as holy work, which it is. And you can regard it as others having an important position. You can give lectures at the Agudas Yisrael conventions and things like that. And I also think we can't take away from the fact that these people are not the people who want to be sitting and learning in Kollel all day. Yeah, that's, as we'll see, Rav Shach's whole problem with this. And many of them don't want to live in Lakewood-type communities. They like living in Los Angeles or New York. Rav Shach, however, was very upset with all this. And he writes about this in one of his books. He saw this stress on Kiruv, which is enormous in the Haredi world, the stress on Kiruv, as something new and something which is watering down the traditional emphasis and dedication to Torah study. What is the traditional Haredi position? Torah study above all else, complete dedication. And there's no question he's correct in that. Although, like I said, those who have been pushing the Kiruv program feel, obviously, that in today's day and age, with so much intermarried and so many Jews that have been lost, it's almost 8 lawsuits. It's an emergency measure that we need to do Kiruv. But Rav Shach, though, I mean, in general, he has a love-hate relationship with the non-religious. On the one hand, he makes statements, terrible statements, how the non-religious are not even Jews. Now, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe is very upset about these sorts of statements. On the other hand, these are not halachic statements. They're rhetorical statements. Just like we might say, and this is probably terrible for us as well, to say about some assimilated Jew, he's a real guy. I mean, Rav Shach certainly wasn't referring to it halachically, but Chabad actually took a lot of these statements in Chabad in Israel, and they reprinted them in a little booklet in order to show Rav Shach in a bad light, that rather than loving the non-religious, he hates them, which isn't true. He didn't hate them, but he would say very negative things when he got going. But Rav Shach's tradition always was, quality is better than quantity. The Haredi leadership from day one was always prepared to see numerous Jews go off the derech, as they say today, leave Orthodoxy, then create schools which would have secular studies. Rabbi Dessler has a famous letter in which he explains why we do not create schools with secular studies, even though we'll keep the young. Because if we don't create them, their parents are going to send them to the non-Jewish schools. He says, because our job is to create Torah scholars. And we're not going to water down our curriculum because of concern about others. I mean, this is, Rabbi Schwab has an open letter against this. He was shocked. How can you just give up on all these people? But the Haredi mentality was that we focus on great Torah scholars, and Rav Dessler even quotes the Rambam, that, you know, it's better one success is worth 1,000 failures. That is, you focus on the one who could be a Gadol B'Yisrael. And I discuss this in my book for those who want to see more. So you see, when you have an activity like Kiruv, this challenges the Haredi hierarchy that places Torah study at the top of it. And this is going to be problematic for Rav Shach as well as all traditional Haredim. In fact, Rav Shach writes as follows, downplaying the significance of Kiruv. Quote, even though there are phenomena which bring a bit of joy, mesamchot ktsat, like Baalei Tshuva, but these are individuals or even hundreds, and this has nothing to do with our role and existence as Klal Yisrael, which depends on the study of Torah. In other words, it's very nice to have Baalei Tshuva, and if someone comes into our shul, we try to teach them Torah. But this is not what we're about. We don't go out to do that. Our role is to study Torah, and maybe this could influence them. But this is not what we're not supposed to be focusing on Kiruv. We're supposed to be focusing on Torah study. Which book does Rav Shach say this? It's found in his, email me, I'll send you. It was Mikhtavim Ma'amarim. In fact, I'll give you the exact citation right now because I have it. It's found in volume 5, page 37, if I'm not mistaken. I'll check on it if you want. He has like 5 or 6 volumes of Mikhtavim Ma'amarim. Leo Levy does have a piece independently in an essay, and from the German Orthodox standpoint, which he comes from, makes perfect sense that this would be an outrageous statement, because German Orthodoxy, as we've seen, was devoted not to building up Gedolei Torah, but pious communities. And you certainly had Lithuanian Gedolim who didn't have that position, but that is the position of the Lithuanian elite. And this was, Rav Dessler did not write this letter and explain the position when he was in Europe. He wrote this in Gateshead when they were trying to open up a school in England. And he said that we don't do this. And truthfully, if you look in the Lithuanian world today, they don't do this. They still continue in Israel, the Haredi's educational system. The kids get absolutely no secular education whatsoever. Basic math they don't even get. Zero. It's all Torah study, and that's their position. So in other words, Baalei Tshuva are great, but we don't change our life and our traditions in order to respond to all the non-religious Jews. For Rav Shach, we continue living the way we've always been living, studying Torah. That's our goal. We don't change the way we've been living. And even though this is an important value, we don't change it. They asked Rav Chaim Soloveitchik why he doesn't support Zionism, because Zionism will stop Jewish assimilation. Obviously, if people are proud Jews and they're involved in Zionism, they're not going to assimilate. And Rav Chaim said, I'd rather have 1 million Jews that have a pure hashkafa, pure outlook, then have lots more whose outlook is not pure. And this is the problem from Rav Shach's perspective. We don't change for Zionism. We don't change for Kiruv. We don't change our lifestyle. And the Kiruv movement has required us to put a new value in and change our lifestyle. And if we don't have so many good Jews, that's okay, because quality is more important than quantity. And by going out and devoting your life to outreach, you're substituting another value for the value of Torah study. We'll see, that's the Haredi criticism of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Rav Tzvi Yehuda brought in a different value, settling the land. But from Rav Shach's perspective, there's only one value. That's another, the Gayer fiasco as well, because as I pointed out in my essay in Jewish Week, this Dayan is quoting an Eidah Haredi, Rav Moshe Sternbach, who doesn't believe the state is even a valid entity. They don't see this as important to try to bring in the non-Jews or the non-religious who are married to the non-Jews. For them, that's not a value, because they don't recognize the whole state as being a value. So Hashkafa is really driving this. Rabbi Yisrael Rosen, the head of Tzomet, had an essay this week also in which he pointed out that this Machlokes is really being driven by Hashkafa, by meta-halachic outlooks, because if you believe that certain values are important, you think it's important to rely on certain kulot and leniencies, and the Haredim don't share that. It's policy. it's all very depressing. Now, I believe, though, that Rav Shach's perspective doesn't necessarily apply to all Kiruv groups. I don't know so much about Or Sameach. I get the sense that, as I said, that they still push more of a traditional approach. And by the way, Rav Shach might not have agreed with that either, what they're necessarily doing. But when you look at what he's really responding to are the Eishet Torah types, where, as I mentioned last class, it's a complete reversion of traditional Haredi society. It's the honoring of intermarried people at their dinners. It's the offering of books together with non-Jews. It's the putting up of websites that speak about dating and sports and movies and make it talk about that one essay I just read before. It talks about, this is a Haredi, so-called Haredi writer, writing about how excited he was to meet this actor. And, you know, then, of course, there's some Torah lesson in all this. But what is this if not Tumah? This is the American impurity. This is reducing ourselves. And that Chabad always believed in this. Chabad always believed that you go out into the outer world, you go into these godforsaken places because you're protected by the Rebbe's bracha. And just like the Rebbe goes down into the impurity to help its Hasidim, the Chassid will go out into the impurity. And if he has good Kavanot, he can go to Bangkok, for heaven's sakes, and, you know, trying to bring Torah there. The Haredi position was always, you cannot do this. That our children are more important than those, and our soul is more important, and therefore we don't go out and do these sorts of things. Yes, at the Kotel, you can stand at the Kotel and get someone, but you don't go to these places. And so you see, oh, there's going to be a real problem here. And as I mentioned already, the Slifkin incident, the Haredi Gedolim, when they found out what was actually being taught by these things, it was a problematic. And I mentioned last class Rav Svei himself, who certainly was a follower of Rav Shach, before he attacked Rabbi Lam in that famous attack, he was going off on Eishet Torah. So, as I said, for those who don't know, look at the Eishet Torah's website to see how far this has been removed from traditional Haredi. This is more of like a modern Orthodox type of Kiruv organization. And that's really what's so bad for Rav Shach, is that you're taking yeshiva bachurim and people who could be great Torah scholars, and you're removing them from the yeshiva, and you're mixing them up with all this stuff, when really, according to Rav Shach, we're supposed to be secluded in our ghetto, supposed to be learning Torah. And it's not a question of Chodesh Hashem and the Torah. It's not a thing, like some people maybe misinterpret it, that the Chazon Ish didn't do it, or Aharon Kohler didn't do it, so we don't do it. That's not it at all. You could say that in those days, Orthodoxy was weak, and therefore we had to work on strengthening ourselves. But today, Orthodoxy is strong, so we could do that. It's not that at all. It's that the Kiruv track is getting, it's not, if it would be one thing, if it was taking people who couldn't sit and learn, people who are not that talented, people who are not, for whatever reason. But you have, since it's now an ideal, you have people who could be Gedol Yisrael, who could be great Torah scholars, and they're being led off the path of Torah scholars because they see that there's another value, and that it creates a Yetzer Hara for them, that they could also do something positive. And this was, as we said, the problem with Hesder. There's nothing wrong with army and Torah study. But it can't be an ideal. It can't be a positive thing that people should strive to. And at least from Rav Shach's perspective, this became an ideal, which whenever anything other than Torah study is an ideal, this is a reversal of what we knew from the Chazon Ish, from the Brisker Rav, from all these other Gedolim. He's very intellectually honest, and not all the Haredi Gedolim agreed with him, certainly not. I mean, one of the books he banned, you mentioned Leo Levy, one of the books he banned was a book by Leo Levy, who wrote about the need to, even in a Haredi world, to have more of a secular education. This had the Haskama of Yaakov Kamenetsky. So, I mean, he was not afraid to speak his opinion. He was against the Art Scroll Talmud, I mean, which had the American Rabbanim. And he is intellectually honest. When you say conversion or proselytizing, an issue for Chazal in the ancient world, I mean, we do have it. Certainly, we have examples in the Gemara that, in the Mishnah, the convert comes to Hillel. And that's a big problem. And Hillel converts this convert. He doesn't teach him any Torah. I was reading that these people in Israel in this conversion program, they have to sit for 10 months and learn. And then they have to pass tests. So what did Hillel do? Hillel just told him one halacha, you know, just don't do what's hateful to your neighbor. And but we definitely have converts. We have not just Unculus and others. We have examples, descriptions in rabbinic literature, not just in the Talmud, in Rishonim, of various converts. So it's not a new thing. What's a new thing is, at least according to Tzvi Zohar in his book here, he thinks that the conception of Kabbalah Socha Mitzvot that is today found, that you have to accept all, every last mitzvah, that really first makes its appearance in the 19th century. In any event, we have plenty of examples where Moshe Feinstein explains that you don't need to teach people all the mitzvot. Because in ancient times, we see they didn't teach them anything. As long as they say, we accept it, which means we accept it, and when you teach it to us, then we'll accept it. They don't actually have to know it, after who knows all the mitzvot. So if they say that, and then you teach them a mitzvah, and they don't like the mitzvah, and they don't want to observe it, the gerus is still valid. Because it only matters what happens when they accepted it at the time. Truthfully, it's better if they don't know mitzvot, because then they can't reject it. The problem is if they know the mitzvah, and then they actually say, we reject it. We already saw Rav Chaim Moser says that it depends why you reject it. If you reject it on theoretical grounds, that you don't think, you think it's stupid, versus you accept it, but you recognize that you're not going to be able to follow it necessarily because you're weak. That was the big kula of Rav Chaim Moser. Any example of converts from Chazal who are mumarim, he went back? I don't know of any. We post Chazal, we have example of converts who then left it, but they're regarded. I trust Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, who wrote an article also this week, who says there's no example anywhere in rabbinic literature avoiding a conversion ex post facto, which is why the Dayanim say they're not retroactively annulling a conversion. They're establishing the conversion never took place. But as Rabbi Nun explains, the problem is then that in reality you are retroactively, because if people are living as Jews, there's never such thing as a final conversion. There's only a conversion al Tanai. Now, a conditional conversion, because if you then stop observing, it can be revoked. Now, the Rambam has a very strange language. He does say that certain converts, we watch out for them, implying that perhaps for a certain amount of time, we don't take them 100%. They have to prove themselves. There's a big debate over what that means. I agree with you, Ariz, what you're saying. Rav Shach, yes, I mentioned Rav Shach last class was against learning Rambam Yomi, and he said, he gave the whole justification because Chabad, he didn't say because I don't like Chabad, he said because they're taking Balabatim, and instead of learning Halacha, they're teaching him Rambam, and we don't postulate the Rambam, etc. And I pointed out that the same logic could be used against Daf Yomi, and was used against Daf Yomi by the opponents of Daf Yomi. So I didn't find that very consistent. Yes, now, that's what people point out, the irony, that the Haredim who are opposed to Rav Gorin said that Rav Gorin did what you can't do, you can't annul conversions. Rav Gorin argued that there never was a conversion, that no proof had ever been brought. In other words, here we have a different situation. Here we have a Beis Din. In that situation, Rav Gorin's situation, there was no Beis Din. There was the man claiming he was converted, and there were other people who said that he had been converted, but we have no Beis Din, no record from any court or anything. And Rav Gorin said that since there's no record and we can't trust this person because of various reasons, that's very different than today when you take a Beis Din and said that the Beis Din are Rishayim. That was the word used, that they're Rishayim, and therefore it's invalid. And even then, when Rav Gorin tried to uproot a Chazakah, and remember, he was doing it to save Mamzerim. One other point which should be mentioned, people don't realize this. This court had no authority. This was a divorce case, a husband and wife who were getting divorced after 15 years. And when they went to the court to have the divorce written, this based and said, well, we're not going to write you a divorce because you, woman, you're not Jewish to begin with. So it's not in their jurisdiction. So this whole thing is going to play out. It's very interesting. It's not clear what the Rambam means. He says, we're choshesh, he says, for them, under what circumstances, because some people understand this, like the Ramosha, if I'm not mistaken, says that in certain cases there, we have to see. What does that mean, we have to see? Presumably it would mean a few days or something. Others, though, see it meaning something else, and that as soon as the conversion takes place, it's a valid conversion, and they understand the Rambam's language in a different way. It's not clear, but certainly we never had cases years later or months later where they say it's not a valid conversion, unless you can show, and this everyone would agree with, unless you can show that at the time the people never had any intent on converting properly. But Rav Dachovsky, from the former Dayan, the Haredi Dayan of the High Beis Din, says that's the whole problem, though. How can we ever prove this? In theory, you can say that, But in reality, the conversion takes place in a split second, and how can we ever go back and revisit what a Beis Din did? Because we can never be sure, so we always have to assume they're Jewish, he said. Unless, I guess, if you had a video or something from right before in which they said, I'm just going through this, it's a fraud. But Rav Dachofsky says that in the real world, you can never go back because you'll never know. So maybe in a case or two you can, but certainly in 15,000 cases or however many we're talking about now, you can't go back unless you say that the Beis Din are a group of Rishayim or whatever. And that's why it was important to say that this is an invalid Beis Din, because everyone agrees that if it's an invalid Beis Din, that the gets, the gift are not valid, the gittin are not valid. Just like 20 years, if you see that the witnesses at a wedding were invalid witnesses, it's not a valid wedding. So that's why it was vital to declare Rav Drukman a Rasha. Thank you, Rav Meir Lichtenstein. So we should hear what Rav Meir Lichtenstein has to say. Please email me. I'll try to listen to it for next week. Just to conclude then with Rav Shach, his important point is that Haredim don't go out into the street. We remain a people apart, he says. And that explains why they cannot really be part of the civic life in Israel, be part of the public life, because that's not their role. Now, in one of the biographies of Rav Shach by Rav Shlomo Larinz, he was a member many years of the Knesset from the Lithuanian side, and he just came out with a hagiography, which discusses the Brisker Rav and Rav Shach. He says something very interesting, which I don't know if the censors were able to get to the book, they would have wanted it to go in, but I think it's very telling. First, he talks about how Rav Shach was a very shy person. In fact, Rav Shach used to tell, when he was young, he wouldn't go to people's houses. In those days, you went to people's houses. Every night you ate at someone's different house. It's called tug. In the community, yeshivas did not have dormitories, and they didn't have a dining room, so every night you ate somewhere different. And Rav Shach was shy, so he would not go to people's house. He would stay in the Beis Medrash, and someone would bring him some food, basically bread and water. Only on Shabbos, he overcame his shyness and would go to someone's house because he had obligated to have meat on Shabbos. And we're also told in this book that people would constantly come to his house to ask him for advice, and in order to stop him from being bothered, one of the local girls' schools told the girls that they were not permitted to go bother Rav Shach. And Rav Shach told the head of the school to let the girls come. You know, so you see already the shyness on the one hand, and the notion, the recognition that he's an important person and he has a role to play. And we're also told by Lorenz that he loved his privacy. When he used to have to get from Nebrach to Jerusalem, rather than have someone drive him, he would take a bus to Tel Aviv, and then a bus from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Because on the bus, he'd be by himself. If he was in a car, constantly people were talking to him, etc. On the bus, he could think, he could go over his shiurim, he could do what he wanted, and finally have peace and quiet. In his house, there was never peace and quiet. People were constantly coming in. Then this is what's interesting, and that which I don't know if the censors would have put in. Rav Shach explained to Lorenz what his greatest Gehenim was. What he thought was, he felt Gehenim in this world. And he said that when he's in the midst of developing a Chiddush, an important Talmudic concept, and while he's doing it, someone comes in to talk to him with his problems, and he can't finish his Chiddush because he has to speak to this person. That is his greatest Gehenim. I think this might have been censored, is because you're supposed to portray him as always being willing, wonderful to greet everyone, etc. And he says that this he feels is his greatest Gehenim, that he's giving up what's the most important, and this is his greatest suffering. But he has to do it because, I mean, here you see the dialectic here. On the one hand, he wants to be an ivory tower figure. He constantly wants to get away and be by himself. On the other hand, he knows that he has a responsibility, and he's constantly being brought back in into the world of Maaseh, of Maisa. But he feels that it's an obligation, but he feels like he's suffering. He's being punished. And that's his Gehenim, that he has to do this, because there's no one else who's going to do it. So he has to do it, but he doesn't want to do it. He wants to just sit and learn Torah. And I think that we, especially who are not in the Haredi world, can also say that it's unfortunate that he had to be pulled in to this involvement with politics, because it did lead to such great disputes, not just in the Haredi world, Haredi against Haredi, but with the non-Haredim as well. And I think it's unfortunate for another reason, and that this great Torah scholar, because he was so involved with a political party, he was forced to take positions that would alienate him from other segments of the Torah world. Now, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg writes that a great Torah scholar should never be involved in politics. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have to take political positions. You do. And we do have great Torah scholars who were involved in political parties. The Rav himself was a card-carrying member of Mizrahi. But Rabbi Weinberg didn't agree with that, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach didn't, and Moshe Feinstein didn't. Certainly they had political views, but they did not stake themselves so much so politically that they cut themselves off from the rest. Rav Elyashiv is a perfect example. Today he has cut himself off from the more religious Zionist Torah world, and yet when I was in yeshiva, one of my rabbeim, who was a Merkaz Harav person, would go to Rav Elyashiv with his questions. I don't know, that's just my opinion. Obviously, on the other hand, you can say that if this is your position, you should put your prestige behind it, etc. But it does seem to me, at least, that the super Torah scholars, the one who stands at the top, I think it should be important for them to appeal to all sides. And in Europe, for example, the Rashi Yeshiva, the great Rashi Yeshiva, never even belonged to the Agudas Yisrael, even if they agreed with it, because they didn't want to feel that they were off limits to other people. Rav Moshe himself was actually a member of Agudas Yisrael, but it was just more of like a card-carrying member. He had no real involvement. He was more of an Agudas Rabbanim person. Agudas Yisrael, they would ask him questions, but he was not identified, and everyone asked him shaylos. Unlike Rav Shach, who really was identified with a political party, and Rav Shach thought that as a very positive thing. He thought that this was a very good thing to be involved, but the problem is that so many people who are not in his party. I would conclude these talks and say, like I said about the Satmar Rebbe and about others, that and Rav Gorin as well, that hopefully in the future all the politics will have worn off and no one's going to remember the machlokas of Degela Torah and Aguda or Degela Torah or Rav Shach and Hezer, and we'll be able to just take the Torah and one of his books, by the way, Bezot HaNivoteach, is full of great Gedolim stories, and his Torah learning is, you know, his Rambam books is of the highest level. Unfortunately, we're in an era when the politics, it creates problems. Not for me, I like to study it all, but there are many people today who won't want to go near the Satmar Rebbe, won't go near Rav Shach or the Soloveitchik, and it's unfortunate, but that's where we are. Okay, well, please email it to me, David. It's hard for me to write it down now. I'd love to listen to it or to watch it. I'll just briefly, I did speak about it, about his relationship to the religious Zionist family in the two classes previously. In the book, biography of him, one chapter is called To Live with a Paratrooper Grandson. And the idea being that he had to live in his own life was much more complicated than the image he put forth and the Das Torah he put out, because his own son rejected his father's approach and adopted the Mizrahi approach. And you can go visit. I spoke to his son once. You can go visit him. Wonderful man living in Jerusalem now. During his lifetime, you see from Lorenz's book, I mentioned this already, that there were some problems. Maybe a bit of tension. His father refused to hold up the funeral, as I mentioned, for Dr. Schach to come back from America. And it was only years later when Lorenz convinced him that it was because of Torah study. If they didn't have the funeral, then the yeshiva students would be one more day where they wouldn't have real Torah study. But who knows? The inner dialectic of that relationship must have been quite interesting. But he did have a son, but this is not unusual. Almost all the Gedolim of a generation ago, of two generations ago, had children who either became non-religious or became Mizrahi. I'm talking about the Aguda Gedolim. Almost down the line, almost every one of them had a child who did not follow the father's path. It was to be expected. In fact, in those days, you were thankful if your son remained religious. So many of them were non-religious. And I'm talking about the greatest Torah scholars. Yechezkel Abramsky had two sons, one who became a real communist and one who was totally alienated from him. I mean, and this is down the line, Gedolim. It was the era. I don't think Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky had one sibling who remained religious. That's what makes Moshe Soloveitchik so unusual. All of his children, he had five children, if I'm not mistaken, three boys and two girls, every one remained religious. Where else do you find an example like that? It's unheard of. Look at the Lubavitcher Rebbe. His two brothers, neither of them are religious. Now they've tried to recreate them. There's a Chabad group that has a whole website. They call this brother, the mathematician, a great tzaddik, etc. He was a Machal Shabbos Lefarhesia in Tel Aviv on the street. Everyone knew him. You can go to, say, Robinson Books, a big bookseller I buy books from. He was on the same street. I mean, he'd smoke on Shabbos. I mean, these are dvarim yiduim. But the fact that he had a son who became Mizrahi, that's actually a positive thing, and I think... Who else? Children didn't become religious? down the line. It's hard to find one gadol. I mean, literally one. The Tzvi Pesach Frank, or the Klatskin, the Altar of Sabatka, the Ponevezer Rosh Hashiva. Literally, it is almost impossible to find one gadol, other than Ramosha Soloveitchik, who did not have one child that either became a Zionist or a communist or intermarried, etc., etc. That was the era. It's not like today. That was the era. Orthodoxy, and look at the gadolim who came to America. It's hard to find any grandchildren today who are religious. Rav Chaim Hirschenson, someone now who's just coming back to Orthodoxy. That's just the way of the world. What can we do? No, the Brisker Rob's kids in Jerusalem, in Israel, they all remained religious. Not Rav Yossi, Rav Chaim. I think Rav Chaim had one who was not religious, if I'm not mistaken. The Brisker Rob's kids all remained religious and all remained the same ideology. I'm positive Rav Chaim had one of Rav Chaim's children were not religious also. He's already the next generation. I'm talking about kids who grew up any time from 1890 to 1920. The forces were so strong for irreligiosity. When I say the forces, Zionism, academics, Jewish type of stuff, secularism, socialism, and communism. You heard of Rav Itzel Miponovej? One of his sons was such a leading communist, he was arrested for revolutionary activities. Rav Itzel had to visit him in jail. This is the era. I don't know, Yisrael. I don't know. Maybe we should make up a list of all the gadolim. But the question is, it's the ones who didn't. It's literally down the line. Another one, I mentioned by Klatskin, Eliel Klatskin, one of the most important gadolim. One of his children, who became Yaakov Klatskin, the great Zionist, I think he's an atheist, a philosopher, he still remains on very good terms with his father. And he published the Chiddushei Torah in his youth. Grandson or great-grandson of Rav Chaim was an advisor to Nelson Mandela. Yeah, I don't know. Once you get into the grandchildren, and I believe one of the sons of Rav Chaim, I'll have to check it, not the Brisker, not the Rav Beis Halevi, I believe it's one of the sons of Rav Chaim, was non-religious, but I could be wrong about that. Thank you, David. The altar son, he comes to America, and he drives a bus or something. The Mirror Rosh Hashiva, Yaakov Weinberg writes about the Mirror Rosh Hashiva, Rav Herzog, of course. Again, it doesn't pay to go through the list because almost every single one of them had children. Okay, any other questions or comments? And if not, we're going to move on to Rav Cook. Now, Rav Cook didn't have any children like that, but of course, raising them in Israel, that was a little bit different. Europe, it was a much harder situation.